Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Veritas Forum stands for openness and for a willingness to face the hard questions and perhaps to say you don't know when you don't know. And that is exactly the spirit of both philosophy and I think the spirit of Jesus Christ. So we're going to talk about some things tonight that have come to a head in our time, and I've used the names of Nietzsche and Jesus Christ to try to represent that. I really want to emphasize that I'm not here tonight to attack Nietzsche or, for that matter, Jesus Christ, but rather to try to give them voice as it concerns fundamental matters for the contemporary world. Freedom and truth are not easy things to talk about. And they're not easy to talk about because they're so important, and also because those words have been dragooned into serving causes that do not necessarily have to do either with freedom or with truth. And so it is difficult to think seriously about them. This evening I'm going to try to not be obscurely philosophical about it. And that's hard, you know. Philosophers are supposed to be able to go down deeper and stay down longer and come up drier than anyone else. So, you know, I feel like my reputation is at stake. I'm going to try to say some things very simply and clearly about truth and freedom as they have come to meet one another in our contemporary world. It's not easy to think about Nietzsche, and it's not easy to think about Jesus Christ. It's amazing how names and personalities and concepts become encrusted so that sometimes the very thing they were concerned to get at is lost. But this evening, we're going to try to put a sympathetic face on both Nietzsche and Christ and try to hear what they had to say. So let's begin with Nietzsche. Nietzsche has become very important on the campus and in the culture today because he has come to stand for something that was coming to a head in his own day, though he himself did not see much of the success that was to come to him later. Really, he has become successful in culture generally only after the Second World War. The views that Nietzsche expresses are not particularly his own. He was not a driving force in culture and is not a driving force in culture today, but a symbol of something much deeper than he himself. Nietzsche, we might say in California language, caught a wave. And that wave was the reaction of the world of art and intellect against something that we can only loosely call Christian culture. And Nietzsche experienced it deeply, not only in his own family life, but as he prepared himself as a young scholar, and then later as he became a member of the faculty at the University of Basel. What was happening at that time was there was a great wave of reaction against the power of a Christian ideology that was without real spiritual vitality. That perhaps came most clearly to a head in England under the form of the controversy over allegiance to the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church, which people had to swear fealty to if they were to be a faculty member at Oxford or at Cambridge. The institutions of Christian society and government were, to a large degree, not based on what they professed. The reality of God. Everyone said, as we say on our coins today, "In God we trust." But it was clear that they did not trust in God. They trusted in their own abilities, in their capacity to form cliques and power groups and move in ways that they wanted to, often about very trivial matters. And Nietzsche saw that. The culture professed to live for love of God and of neighbor. But as he looked at life as it was really lived around him in the universities and in the towns, and it's very hard for us today to recapture the extent to which the discourse of the university up and well into this century, not only in Germany and France, but here and in England, was so explicitly and thoroughly Christian. It's difficult for us to capture that now. But that's the way it was. And Nietzsche looked at it and saw the irrelevance of God to what was actually being done, to knowledge, to morality, to academic and cultural life. And it was really a revulsion against a system of hypocrisy, even hypocrisy about inquiry and truth. I'll read a few quotations from him in a moment about this, that led him to the point to where, as a very young man, he was, I think, the youngest man who had been appointed to a professorate such as he held, and within a few years he resigned. And he gave as his reason health. But Kaufman and others who have studied this are quite sure that health was not the reason, that rather it was a revulsion against a system, a social system, that he simply could not bring himself to be a part of. Knowledge in this period was more and more divorced from theology, the church, and God. There's a very interesting story about Noah Porter, the president of Yale in the 1880s, and William Graham Sumner. William Graham Sumner decided to use a book on sociology by Herbert Spencer in his course. And Noah Porter read the book. The presidents in those days read the books that were used and had a responsibility to the board to say whether or not it could be used. And Noah Porter read Spencer's book and realized that it had absolutely nothing to say about God. And the subject was sociology or political science. And so Porter went to William Graham Sumner and said to him, "Why is it that this book that you have selected says nothing about God?" Now here's the reply that Sumner gave, and it's deeply revelatory of the deep structure of academic life at the time and the change that was coming. Sumner said to Porter, "The reason that the book has nothing to say about God is because God has nothing to do with the subject matter." Now take a moment and just think about that phrase. It doesn't sound shocking, I suspect, to you today that someone would say that. But that's because we have now acclimated ourselves to the idea that you can be the best educated and best informed person in the world and know nothing about God. See, I suspect that Many of you feel kind of even a resistance to thinking the idea that God has any relevance to the subject matter. Now, what I'm saying is that up until this period of change, it was simply assumed. As the medieval said, theology is the queen of the sciences. And those of you who have read Descartes' Meditations will know how he reworks that so that he also says you can't know anything until you know God. Because that's the only way you could possibly know that even your clear and distinct ideas were true, as if God guaranteed them. And so this was an assumption. Now we come to a period. Now what Nietzsche does is to recognize that this has happened and that people are not being honest about it. And now this is the meaning of his famous phrase that God is dead. Nietzsche was not declaring that he had killed God or proven that God was dead. He was saying rather that as far as our culture, our European culture, how it goes, if God were dead, it wouldn't make any difference. And now, Nietzsche stands for a certain representation of academic life and knowledge that came out of that period and now in our campuses and in our culture is almost automatically assumed on many sides. And that view of knowledge I shall call constructionism. Constructionism, if you want to write the word down to think about, constructionism. And Nietzsche very clearly expresses this view in his writings. And constructionism is the view that the world as we know it is a construction of the human mind, of language, of social structures. And the identities in terms of which we think and live are products of certain processes of living, that they have a history. We count things as the same or different. We classify them in the way they do because it enables us to realize our purposes. And Nietzsche thought that this was also an oppressive thing, and we're very familiar with that today, aren't we, as well? The idea that the constructions that are formed are then oppressive on individuals. And the lines that are drawn give expression not to truth, but to power. Once you abandon the capacity of the mind to grasp a real world, which is what was really coming to a head with Nietzsche, and it had been developing for a couple of centuries from even from the time of Descartes on, you lose the capacity of the mind to grasp a real world, then what is to determine how the mind organizes its world and its life? There's just a show of appearances, and we arrange them, and we arrange them in terms of our will. And all there is appearance and how we arrange them under the direction of our will. And so for Nietzsche, the will to power becomes the ultimate principle of everything, including the academic and, of course, the spiritual, ecclesiastical, historical, government, or whatever like. I just want to read one line or two here from him, from The Genealogy of Morals, Essay 3, and it's in the Section 7. Now here's what he says. In every animal, including the philosophical beast, which is his name for human beings, every animal strives instinctively for the optimal conditions under which it may release its power. Every animal, instinctively and with a subtle flair that leaves reason far behind, abhors all interference that might conceivably block its path to this optimum. And he says in parentheses, the path I am speaking of does not lead to happiness, but to power. This was very crucial for Nietzsche. He called the form of ethics that was most prominent in England, namely hedonistic utilitarianism, he called it a pig's philosophy. Happiness is not what life is about. Power is what it is about. The path that we're leading to for anyone, now this is his general theory now, is simply realizing our power. And anything we do is simply a manifestation of that same instinctual drive. And this is what he calls the will to power. That what people want is the exercise and use of their power. And everything else they do, if they call it by the name truth or holiness or whatever, is actually an expression of this drive for power. And so out of that then comes the constructionism. The constructionism is merely an exercise in constructing a world that will be suited to the use of our power. And now some of you will have studied Nietzsche more, and you will know, for example, he has a whole account of how the Judeo-Christian ethic became dominant. It was a power play on the part of weak people who were resentful and clever enough to dupe the strong people into thinking that they were wicked because they were strong. And that actually you were better if you were weak. And so blessed are the poor. Blessed are they that mourn. No, blessed are they that are strong, see. And so he has a theory about how these things come about through the exercise of the will to power. And the slave morality of the Bible, as he called it, the slave morality, was simply a clever device through the exercise of power. And Nietzsche recognized among the ascetics, the monks of the Christian tradition, some of the greatest exercises of the will to power. Because to forego life and to pledge oneself to poverty and to obedience and to celibacy were things that exercised a great will to power. Well, you may sense that's a very contrived explanation. But you see, once you have accepted the view that the mind is not capable of grasping a reality that exists independently of itself, and that is what came through the history before Nietzsche, then there is nothing left but some sort of internal principle to try to explain why we think as we do and why we live as we do. And so cognitive constructivism and moral and social constructivism are perhaps a way of answering the question. What Nietzsche, the version of the mind that Nietzsche accepts is actually what we call phenomenalism. It is a way of saying that all there is that we can grasp consists of appearances, or Nietzsche likes to use the word perspective, and all we have are perspectives, and that there isn't anything more other than the will to organize them in a certain way. Those of you who have read Hume and perhaps others such as John Stuart Mill or Ernst Mach, or in this period A.J. Eyre or Nelson Goodman, will recognize that position. So then all that is left is the perfection of the individual will. And that means life lived with a will at its greatest strength, its most intense integration of self-aggrandizement. And only that gives a point to life. And so some of Nietzsche's most characteristic sayings are derived from that. For example, he says, one of the things he says is, build your house under the volcano. Well, you think about that now. That would do something for your will, wouldn't it? Right? but that sort of defiance of the individual will to the whole world, and finding in the individual will the only value, because Nietzsche is not actually a nihilist, as he's often called. He had a very healthy form of values. And it was all tied to this idea that the degree to which one succeeds in bringing the whole of the individual life under it, under the will, is the degree to which one is a good, a healthy person. Now, you may recognize in this things that are similar to writers such as Kierkegaard or Dostoevsky or others in the 19th century. And indeed, the 19th century was a period in which, with the growth of science and technology, though it doesn't look like much perhaps compared to what we have today, with that growth was an increasing sense of the loss of individuality. And in reaction, then, people saying, I will defy the whole world. I'll defy causal law. Dostoevsky says in The Underground Man, what are the laws of arithmetic to me? Right? If that's all you know are these general truths and your will is shriveled, then you're nothing. And so that's a general tendency now that comes out of constructionism, which locks the mind into its own little world and leaves the will with nowhere to go except to turn back on itself and find fulfillment in its own self-assertion. Now, do I need to tell you that Nietzsche won? Remember what I've said when you watch the commercials on television and watch where the focus is. And it will be almost 100% on the realization of self-will. And how if you buy this kind of car or that kind of smell good or whatever, then you will be unique, along with several million other people. Now, Nietzsche leaves us then in a position where, for example, in a university setting, about the only thing that we can appeal to in recommending our university is the degree of personal success which you may have if you come and study with us. A few remarks may be made about community. Almost nothing will be said about family, but a lot will be said about individual creativity and the capacity to exercise judgments that will be valued, and people will pay you a lot of money to work for them. You see, that's a natural outcome of the picture of the enclosed mind and the will turned back on itself that naturally comes out of Nietzsche. I want to say again, I don't want to dump on Nietzsche. I want to say again, Nietzsche was not so much an instigator as he was a person who expressed what had already come to realization in his culture. And he was ahead of his day, so he was regarded as dangerous, loony, or whatever for a long while, but he really comes into his own, especially after the First World War. Because the First and Second World Wars were a revelation of a culture which Nietzsche had already decided was hopeless. And his insights into that is something that we really do need to treasure. So what we see in Nietzsche is a natural outworking of what we've come to know as modernism. Now, modernism stands above all. It's a very complicated concept, and please forgive me for being overly simple-minded. Now, we're going to have questions and comments after a while, and you can save me from as much as you can. And I do invite you to do that. As anyone who talks for 45 minutes is bound to say a number of things that are badly mistaken. And so But let me just put it this way, that modernism comes to stand for the rejection of the past as a guide to the present. I will say that again because it's so central. Modernism comes to stand for the rejection of the past as a guide to the present. Once it is clear that knowledge cannot find a basis in the individual consciousness, and that is the outcome of philosophy from Descartes to Nietzsche. Now, once that is established, you've gotten rid of the past. At least you've called it so seriously into question that it can no longer be used as a guide. And if we had time tonight, we'd spend a lot of time talking about how that happened, especially in relationship to the church, to the Bible, to the history of both the Jews and the Christians, and how history was lost, and the modern philosophers tried to regenerate morality on the basis of eternal truths that they could find by thinking. And that is what modernism tried to do. And it tried to take the religion of the past with all of its history and get rid of it because that was divisive. And I'm addressing this because this is so relevant to today. And the way around the divisiveness is to recognize, as was thought, that if you would just set the history aside and instead think about the moral truths which the history was supposed to illustrate in one way or another, then there would no longer be divisiveness. And of course, one of the issues that gave rise to modernism was an attempt to get out of the religious wars and strifes of Europe. So we just have these moral truths that come up now, but then once you begin to examine the mind, and you find that all you've got is your mind, then you begin to ask the question, where do these universal truths come from? Right? How can we say we have universals when we can't even escape our own mind? Right? And Descartes didn't really succeed with that, except to his own satisfaction, and that's one of the occupational hazards of philosophers, is to be satisfied with their own line of reasoning. But almost no one was. And so through a period of time, coming up to Kant, then Hegel and Schopenhauer, and then Marx and Nietzsche, and then beyond that, Freud and others picking it up, the whole idea of truths upon which you could base your life disappearing. Now this is what I want to try to emphasize. What is then left? And the answer is individual will. Individual will. And so, as Alistair MacIntyre has portrayed so very well in his writings, especially a book called Whose Justice and Whose Rationality, all of a sudden the basis of practical reason is shifted to the point that mere individual desire is a reason for doing what you want. I pause over that statement again because we're apt to say, well, what else? See, that's how thoroughly we have been formed by this. I say mere individual desire is thought to serve as a basis for action. Right? Now, that was not so until the period comes in modern thought where you have this artifact of the individual on their own. The individual on their own. Well, Nietzsche saw how this was working, you see, and he then went so far as to say, well, it isn't just a matter of religion. Our philosophers themselves are actually fooling themselves when they talk about truth. And he used words like antichrist, skeptic, nihilist, and so on, to characterize the people who went about destroying beliefs in the name of truth. And now he says, What about these people themselves? What about these earnest scholars, philosophers, scientists of today? And he says, well, it is they. These are the ones. The professors, the writers, the scientists, they represent the ascetic ideal today. It's not monks, it's not preachers, it's not holy books. They are the ones who deny themselves for the sake of truth. Ah, he says, but these men too are a long way from being free spirits because they still believe in truth. Interesting. They still believe in truth. But, Nietzsche said, they don't actually act that way because what they're pursuing is really their own self-will. And they use references to truth to hide that, to keep us from seeing what is really going on. But, he said, now one of Nietzsche's favorite words for himself was psychologist. But he said, when we really come to understand what they're doing, we see nothing but unvarnished will to power again. Well, truth then becomes simply another passion. It too is no longer something that we can look at as a way of guiding ourselves because it is just an expression of our self-will. And the 20th century joins Nietzsche in affirming that truth is what? We put the word in Latin here on the front, veritas. And it's much more dignified in that way. But if you say truth in most places on the campuses I'm familiar with, people will immediately say, whose truth? And this, I think, is the deepest revelation of how thoroughly Nietzsche won the first round of this battle between Christian teaching, Christ, if you wish, though I hope you pick up from this that what Nietzsche was criticizing may have had very little to do with Christ, but at least that's how it was represented. And Nietzsche won the first round, and truth is lost. Any sort of universal is lost. Pragmatism, existentialism, positivism, linguistic constructionism, deconstruction, hermeneutics, and probably several other things that we could mention as currently important for our discussions on the campus become ascendant. There was now no accessible body of moral knowledge. And I pause again to just let you think about that. There's no accessible body of moral knowledge that currently functions in our culture. If someone wants to know many things in mathematics or history, or that you know where to send them. Now, if someone wants to know how to be a good person, where do you send them? Would you send them to Stanford for that purpose? I hope you won't send them to USC for that purpose. Maybe Stanford's better in that regard. See? Now, I just want you that to soak in a moment. See, this is where Nietzsche comes in. Because if there is no body of moral knowledge, then all that is left is will. All that is left is impulse. Really, after a while, nothing that can be called in a very serious sense will is left. But now the process is over. We've been through offloading all of this burden of the past, call it Christianity or whatever you want to call it. But we've been through that. And now we can have battles over whether or not we will post the Ten Commandments in a courthouse or something of that sort. But it isn't about knowledge. It's about symbolism on both sides. no one would dare to enforce them by grading. You could never grade someone on whether or not they thought the Ten Commandments were true. And that's just a way of saying, of course, we don't treat it as knowledge. Well, the heart of the issue here really is truth. The issue between Nietzsche and now I'm going to talk about Jesus Christ, and I'm not going to try to split and start all the hairs that have to do with Christianity and so on. I'll just talk about Jesus Christ. I'd like to ask you to try to think of him as a serious person in the area of information. See, that's the burden of human life. The burden of human life is to find an adequate basis for human action in knowledge. To find an adequate basis for human action in knowledge. Now, we accept that naturally in our courses. I hope we do. Though, in fact, I can't be too sanguine about that, because I often ask my students, did you believe what you wrote on the test? They laugh. See, we're a culture where what is important is to know the right answers, not necessarily to believe them. Still, I think we need to just simply say that the heart of the issue between Nietzsche and Jesus Christ is truth and its relationship to human freedom, well-being, and fulfillment. Okay, since that's a major turning point now and we're heading for home, I'm going to say that again. The heart of the issue between Nietzsche and Jesus Christ is truth and its relation to freedom and human well-being and fulfillment. Okay, so thou shalt not steal. What does that have to do with freedom? The assumption of Nietzsche and the modern tradition, which he completes and then represents more effectively perhaps than anyone else after the Second World War, the assumption of that modern tradition which he completes is that we are closed off individually and socially by our language, our culture, our history, or just our mind. And that we cannot find our way out to an other which is reliably there, which we haven't somehow made and created by our own thinking and feeling or by our culture's thinking or feeling. Now see, the inability to do that is what turns us back on the individual will. It turns us back on ourselves and our will as the ultimate reality in our life. Freedom then means only freedom from. Freedom from. See, Descartes in his mind found that he was free from a world. But then, how does he get to that world? And the declaration of freedom that we make in a mind that is closed off and lost in itself is actually an imprisonment of a kind. And the modern attempt to deal with the mind and its grasp of the world, see, has its... The backside of that is the increasing emphasis on freedom as merely freedom from. And we are condemned to our aloneness. Self-preoccupation is our only possibility. And doing what we want, our only conception of human fulfillment and well-being. And here's how the prison works. Someone says, "What shall I do?" And we reply, "Do what you want." And the honest person says, "I don't know what I want. I don't know what I want. What do you want? What do you really want? See, that's how Nietzschean freedom traps us. Is now we don't know what we want. And in this structure, desire as a reasonable human capacity defaults into impulse. Because as living beings, we have to act. And curiously enough, we wind up in a world where we desire to desire. We have a Viagra society. What is Viagra about? It is about desiring to desire. An addiction in its many forms is an attempt to escape the loneliness that is enforced by a will uprooted from a world of truth and reality. Ernest Barker, a well-known political theorist of the last century, said, "The core of democracy is choice and not something chosen." I say that again. The core of democracy is choice and not something chosen. See, that's how the will turns back on itself. Well, representing a different tradition than the box-end mind, I read a word or two here from a man named T.H. Green, who was writing at the end of the last century. He says, "When we speak of freedom, we should consider carefully what we mean by it. We do not mean merely freedom from restraint or compulsion." See, that's freedom from. "We do not merely mean freedom that just sets us free from other things. We do not mean merely freedom to do as we like, irrespective of what we like. We do not mean a freedom that can be enjoyed by one man or one set of men at the cost of a loss of freedom to others. When we speak of freedom as something to be so highly prized, we mean, da-da, a positive power or capacity of doing or enjoying something worth doing or enjoying, and that too, something that we do or enjoy in common with others. We mean by it a power which each man exercises through the help and security given by his fellow men and which he in turn helps to secure from them." You see? See, that's an entirely different conception of freedom. Now, that's a freedom that is appropriate to a mind that has a world, that is open to a world. And there is another tradition about the mind. It existed long before the modern period. It is represented in the Old Testament and New Testament and St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas and comes all the way up to the present. And yes, there are people today, in the 20th century, who represented people like Levinas and Edmund Husserl and even Martin Heidegger. And the primary word that is used there for those of you who are into these things is intentionality. And intentionality refers to the openness of a mind to what is there. A mind which doesn't create a world. A mind which the world inhabits through intentionality, and of course in the Christian tradition that God inhabits. So God is always already there, and that's the basic Augustinian teaching about the nature of the mind. The inner light, the inner teacher, is God, and it is interacting with the mind and enables it to reach out to a world which God and not the mind created, and to find in that world, with others who are there, the proper support of a will that is capable of moving to genuine freedom. See, if you want to see freedom, you don't look at a kid jumping around with nothing to do. You see freedom when you see an accomplished artist sit down at a piano and play something so beautiful. that you can hardly stay in your seat. That's freedom. When Pavarotti steps up and does what he does, the incredible magic, that's freedom. Now, how did he get there? He didn't get there by turning in on himself. He took the step that is always first in freedom, which is to submit himself to reality. That's the first step in freedom. And for that, you need truth. Because you see, truth is what guides you to reality. Reality you can just think of as what you run into when you're wrong. That's what that is. That's reality. Now, truth can help you avoid those unpleasant occasions. See? Because truth enables you to represent how things are without running into it, and to submit your will to reality through truth. I don't think you have a hard time with that, just thinking about ordinary life. I'm not saying all truth is easy to grasp or anything of that sort, but the basic idea of truth is very simple. A child picks it up immediately. If you don't believe it, promise them something and then don't do it. See, they know what truth is. And they know what falsity is, and they know how important it is to try to manage reality by falsehood. See? Did you do that? No. He did it. See, that's trying to manage it. But the important thing to understand is that real world is there. See, and that is the tradition that has developed out of the ancient world and up into the present until the theory of mind, according to which your mind actually gets in the way of knowing the world and makes it impossible, according to some writers, many writers, that theory of mind set aside the theory of truth, which made freedom possible. Now, you need more than truth for freedom. You need community. And just a word or two about this, because it's so very important. You see, a little child, when he comes into this world, for example, has to bond with another person. The theory of bonding is one of the deepest and most important things, I think, that has come out of recent studies over the last decades. And how children who are not able to step into a world that is already there simply cannot start, and they'll die. And if you're familiar with this literature, if you're not, you might want to just look up bonding and come to know. Because, you see, we depend for our life. See, a little child comes into the world, it has to step into life that is already going. And if it doesn't, it will not live. It's just that simple, and it isn't just a physical matter. What goes on when the child looks into the eyes of the mother and the mother into the eyes of the child? See, that is very deep in terms of what that child is. And then as that child grows, it has to trust that world, and it cannot trust that world unless it finds truth. So human fulfillment comes through community in which there is trust and there is truth, and the will is enabled to grow so that it takes in what is not a part of itself and makes that a part of its life. Now, if you can think just for a moment of Jesus, not as a kind of sanctified religious figure, just think of him as someone who knew what he was talking about. Which, you know, you might, if you just stop to think about it, you might think that was true of him. And so he's here with his little community of students or disciples, and he's telling them, now, if you live in what I say, then you really are my apprentices, and you will come to know the truth about life. And of course, here we're talking about the kingdom of God and the reality of the world and what community is and what love is and all of those things. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Now go back very simply. Think about freedom as the capacity to live fully in a world. The capacity to live fully in a world. So let the winds of freedom blow. What does that mean? Give peace a chance? What's that? Right? I mean, how do you do those things? So now, this is the rematch. The rematch between Jesus Christ and Nietzsche is in life. It's in your life. And you are the heir of a Nietzschean culture, and I am too. And don't mean to accept myself just because I'm using the pronouns here the way I am. I mean, we're all in this. This is the world. We have a Nietzschean world. And the question is whether or not you can find freedom in that world. And you have another world over here, which is presented by Jesus Christ. Think of him now as a moment as an intelligent person who would be very much at home here on this campus. Probably could teach us a thing or two. Now he says, if you put my teachings into practice, then you will be my apprentices and I'll be your teacher, and you will come to know the truth about life and the world, and in knowing that truth, you will find genuine fulfillment as the human being you were meant to be. That's the rematch. It isn't something that can be argued out abstractly or proven by words. It has to be put into practice. That's the test. I don't need to tell you what the outcome will be. No one has yet managed to find fulfillment in the way that Nietzsche recommended. Nietzsche himself did not find it in that way. And I don't say that to dump on Nietzsche. Okay, I'm very sympathetic to Nietzsche. In fact, Nietzsche is one of the people that brought me into philosophy. He didn't know it, but he did. And it was because of the incisiveness with which he addressed real issues in life. And we need to be as incisive as he was. Right? But we need not to be under the false assumptions about the nature of the mind and the will that he was under. And I believe the way we can escape that is to take the teachings of Jesus about life and as critically, as skeptically as you wish, put them into practice and test them. That's the only test. And if the test of life shows that actually Jesus wins the second round, then that's no shame on Nietzsche. That's our opportunity. All right, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, you'll stay up here with me. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. You're very gracious. Now, be as ungracious as you can be. And any comments or questions, and really, I'll do the best I can to answer, and if I can't, I'll just say I don't know.
Unfortunately, we only have one microphone for questions, which is right up here.
Yes.
So you may need to move around so you can get to that place. And I would ask you to keep the introductions to your questions brief so that everyone else can go ahead and ask too.
And if someone can't get to the mic, just talk real loud and I'll try to repeat it for the benefit. So any comments? Questions? Yes, sir.
Well, just to get started. Okay, as Christians, we do obviously believe there's an objective order. Let's say the world of the Logos. We believe in the Logos incarnate, so there's a Logos. But is there a place for a kind of phenomenology as a step towards humility? To say, okay, there's an objective world, but I'm not sure I know it, but I can tell you the phenomena presenting themselves.
Yes. Well, that's right. And we don't, I think, need to go all the way to a phenomenology for that. We just need to recognize that position where we are. We don't have an eternal perspective in our own right. And what comes to us, we may not fully understand. Right? And so, now, this is extremely important for us. I think this is one of the reasons why Nietzsche took the turn that he did in his early life was because he saw so many people who did not do this. And, of course, this has been a problem forever because all religion, when it is formed culturally, then begins to take on the human dimensions. And that doesn't necessarily, that doesn't usually include humility. See? Right, I mean, you know the famous saying about Oliver Cromwell sitting in the midst of his bickering brethren, carrying on about this fine point and the other, and finally he says, I beseech you, brethren, by the bowels of Christ, believe that ye may be wrong. Yeah. So that's a wonderful comment. Yes. So, in other words, dogmatism is not a part of the deal. I think I would add on to that, you know, if you could find a better way than the one you're in, even if you are a Christian, Jesus would be the first one to tell you to take it. He's not going to, you can't imagine him saying, well, now you know, that's good, but that's not Christian. I don't think you can imagine him saying that. See, he does. He stands with the truth. That's a good point. Thank you so much. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Right.
And yet they have in Jesus and his teachings. You wouldn't directly challenge anybody saying that they were happy in
by following Nietzsche's teachings.
So even though Nietzsche, you know, didn't fulfill his happiness through his will, you would directly challenge anybody to say that
well,
they have found more of a finer
right. Yes, I didn't get into the comparisons because the comparisons would be difficult to fill out, but I will make the simple statement this way, that as far as I've been able to find, no one has found fulfillment by following Nietzsche's teachings. Now, there may be someone here tonight, and that's fine. I hope to meet you, or maybe you'll speak up now. And now, remember, the basic teaching here is the honest pursuit of self-will, of getting my own way. And that's what I thank you for giving me a chance to be a little more precise about it. See, that's what I'm saying is I don't know of anyone like that. And I've sort of had my ear to the ground on it. And I know of multitudes of people who have made themselves completely miserable and have cut themselves off from everyone who loved them. And by trying to pursue that. And this is where we ought to say, come on, let's see what the cases are. It's an empirical question. Yes. Yes.
A place of there being a reality.
The reality for Nietzsche is will. That's all.
Could you clarify the steps of going, and of course, you said the first step in freedom is to submit oneself to reality. The steps of going from reality being the will to there being another reality there.
Yes. Let me try. You see, take the case of the person who's a concert pianist. Now, when they first belly up to the piano, they experience a great resistance in locating the keys, in time, in all of the kinds of things that, as they submit themselves to the keyboard and to, hopefully, a teacher, then increasingly the keys, instead of standing over against them as obstacles, become stepping stones integrated into their action to reach where they want to go. Now, that's true of any discipline that you enter into. It's the same, no matter a field of knowledge. See, and this is what Jesus is saying when he says, "To him that hath, more shall be given." That's the way the will works. The little child comes into the world, and their big job is to master their bodies. And when they get here, they can't do anything with the thing, except maybe look at you and suckle. You know. And they're almost totally passive before their bodies. And then as they grow, they're able to do more and more. They can walk. Now, when they walk, then they can use the floor in a different way. See? And then that grows increasingly as they master their body, and the world ceases to be an obstacle and becomes integrated in their will. Now, their biggest obstacle is going to be other people. And learning how to interact with other people in such a way that other people are not a barrier to them, but are a part of their willing. Because that requires mutuality in a way that the floor doesn't. Right? Now, I mean, there is a certain mutuality in there too, but the floor isn't sort of waiting to exercise freedom for them. But the other person, Mama, is waiting to exercise freedom, right? And Papa and brother and sister. And so then they grow up and they go to Stanford. Right? And they take sociology 101 and calculus and all these things. What are they doing? They are integrating more and more and more into their will. See, it's so important to understand that not subjectivity, but objectivity is the path to freedom. That's the path to freedom. And yet we have many people, like I've had often, normally I will explain what truth and knowledge are when I start a class now, because I know that my students don't know. And I will point out things like no one makes a belief true by believing it, or by getting their friends to believe it, or by starting a political movement, or getting a grant in favor of it. You can't make beliefs true by believing them. Now, today, many people feel that's oppressive. And I have people tell me, well, you know, that sounds right, but of course, I believe in freedom, and of course, that's oppressive, that I can't make things true the way I want to. And so it's just a total mistake, because freedom comes in truth and objectivity and learning how to interact with it. And that's how the will grows. And I hope that's helpful, because see, it's a general structure. It works with everything having to do with the will. Is you submit, you learn the truth, you move in relationship to whatever it is you're learning, and as you do that, you have greater and greater freedom. So the winds of freedom have to do with truth, right? And a reality which is dependable and enables you to grow beyond yourself. I don't know if you've ever heard Pavarotti talk about other tenors and singing and how he practices. It's just wonderful to hear it, because you just see how he is taken Beniamini and Gigli and all of these other tenors, and he studies them, and they just become a part of him. And then, of course, he's him. Him, them. Let's see. Yes.
How do we differentiate between God's compassion and our will? What I think about this, if God gives one a passion for something, and you pray, believing, ask, and you will receive, and you go on, you're better off maybe following
I think the key here, and this, that's,
question?
Yes, how do you tell the difference between just when a passion is something that is, if you wish, good and right and from God, or it's just you, and it's a little Nietzsche in you, something like that. So, yeah. And I really think the idea here is to see how your passion matches reality. And you do that by exploring it, putting it into action, and then that will lead you into issues involving other persons, involving what you believe to be right and wrong generally. I don't know if you remember a movie called Elvira Madigan some years back. I'm too many years back, I can tell. But it's a story about a young woman and a young man, and they fly in the face of their society to fulfill their passion, and they wind up starving to death and eating grass, and not the kind you smoke, but the kind. And it's so. I really think that we should assume that our passions are good, but we should never follow them in isolation, and that we should relate them to our other passions. And of course, a part of what will go on happen then will be the shaping of ourselves. So if you're going to be Pavarotti, there are a lot of other things you're not going to be, right? And so there's a lot to be said for the Nietzschean idea of individual self-realization, as long as we take it in an objective framework and don't allow ourselves to be obsessed and our will to be turned back on itself. Because that's the way to bondage. And normally the bondage will manifest itself by the way the world closes in on us. So that's what I would suggest on that. Way back here.
Yes, in your book, Divine Conspiracy, and also in some of your lectures around the country, I found it very interesting when I first encountered it. And you made the bold statement that Jesus Christ is the most intelligent man to ever walk the earth.
Right.
And you alluded a little bit to it up here.
Yes.
And I can understand why you wouldn't just want to launch out into it in this context, but to what extent would you bring that into this context here?
Right. I would be very happy to bring it in here and to discuss it at length. Now, it isn't an easy topic because, of course, there are a lot of historical and other details, but if you just start with thinking about the place that Jesus holds in human history, you're going to be forced to recognize that he was very unusual. Now, that's the way I normally go. I don't start by saying, well, you know, he was divine. Right? That's something we can come to, but there's really no point starting there. You start with what you know about him. Right? And what you know about him is that he left his mark on human history as no other person did. Now you can ask questions like, well, why didn't he give James and John the relativity equations? And you will realize immediately they wouldn't have known what to do with it. What do you do with it? They had other things to do. And so I think we need to understand that Jesus's mission was moral revolution. Now, I'm prepared to say it's a lot more than that, but it was that at a minimum. And that you see this written strongly in the incredible things he's recorded as doing in his lifetime, which, if you know the historical context, is just unbelievable that anyone would even think of doing those things. And he was himself regarded as crazy for doing them. But that his purpose was, and that's still going on. See, the moral revolution, which Jesus Christ set forward, it didn't begin with him, it began much earlier, but he set it forward and centered it on his own person, has still a long way to go. Would you agree with that? A long way to go. I mean, just read, if you can stand to watch the first 10 minutes of newscasts. Or the Jane and I, we like to go to movies occasionally, but we have a terrible quandary. Because we can't stand the previews. But if we go after the previews, we can't get a seat. So we go and sort of sit there like this. Oh, God. Normally say, well, that's another one we won't have to see. But I mean, we're surrounded with terrible, terrible things. And anyone who doesn't believe in evil and sin before September the 11th had blinkers on. I mean, and I'm not just, I'm talking both of individual things and social things. So that's our call. Now Nietzsche, one of the many things you have to give credit to Nietzsche for, he realized the moral rot that was at the center of Christian so-called culture. And he was unwilling to overlook it. Unfortunately, it, I believe, turned him in the wrong direction given the basis of thought that had come to him at his time. But, see, that's very serious. And it doesn't just affect people in other parts of the world. It's here. And so that's what he was mainly concerned about. And this is where I talk about things like, well, if you want to see his brilliance, pick up the Sermon on the Mount, try to read it intelligently, give it an adult reading, and try to get beyond the assumptions that are apt to keep you from seeing it for what it is. Read it as a moral treatise. Read it with Plato's Republic, on the other hand. Read it with Kant's Grundlegung. Read it with Rawls' book on theory of justice, see, and compare them. That's where we miss the point with Jesus. We think he's over here in this special category, and we don't ask questions and think about him as if he were an intelligent person. So that's what I will say that anywhere and take my licks. Yes, ma'am. Sure. Because the question is, why is not this just another example of self-will if I recommend fulfillment on the recommend Christianity on the basis of fulfillment? Well, first of all, I don't recommend Christianity. I recommend that you try to listen intelligently, read intelligently Christ and those who through the ages has followed him and try to figure out what they're saying and put it into practice. Now, this is where one of the deepest sayings of Jesus comes into play. And for example, I won't mention any names, but there are some well-known books and tendencies today that emphasize that you should love God because you'll be happy that way. Right. Now, what I would say to you is, if you love God, you'll be happy. But you can't love God by loving happiness. You had to love God and let the happiness take care of itself. This is just another illustration of what is called the hedonic paradox in ethical theory. That is, if you want to be miserable, try to be happy. Right? And so what you try to do is I will tell my students in ethics courses, especially about the end, I hope you find something better in life to do than try to be happy. Happiness is a byproduct. Fulfillment is a byproduct. So it isn't like start out with hot tubs and graduate to Jesus in your quest for happiness. It's rather you readjust. You see, there are good things in this world. That includes other people. That includes bodily activity, creativity, the enjoyment of nature, love of others, love of our families and of our neighbors. And we don't do that in order to be fulfilled. It's just that we are fulfilled only in doing that. Now, see, that goes back to this gentleman's question here of how that works. How does the will go? See, the will that is directed merely at myself is the Nietzschean will. And it will always turn back on itself and shrivel and die because it does not nourish itself on what is beyond it. See, all life requires to be nourished by what is beyond it. You put a little corn seed in the ground, and what has to happen is it must crack and open up and send out little things to eat dirt. That's what it does. See? That's freedom. It sends up little things and it eats sun, right? And it grows. And now it's not reaching for growth, it's reaching for sun, dirt, water. And growth comes naturally. That is, I think, one of the hardest lessons for those of us in contemporary culture to learn, is that what we're really aiming for is something that comes as a byproduct. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am?
In relation dealing with self-will, and you've drawn a distinction between Christ in Nietzsche and his self-will, how would you respond to somebody who claims to have found fulfillment
sure.
in self-sacrifice or love of others without Christ?
Oh, I think many people do. Right. Now, but you see, fulfillment is not the only story. There's also a question of, to what degree were they fulfilled? And here's now a long scale. But many people have found a high degree of fulfillment with no knowledge of Christ at all. But now, see, what Christ does is to come and introduce you into a larger community, the kingdom of God. And the resources of that community and the expanse, the extent of it, in which you can grow. And he says this is supposed to go on for eternity. Right. So you'll never stop growing. So there's a lot of us have thought of Christianity only as a way of making sure we get in. Right. And there's just a lot more to it than that. Yes, sir.
You've spoken about the existence of a reality which is outside of an individual mind. What of the nature of that reality? You mentioned positivism as related to constructivism. Could you say more about that?
Well, I will try. The problem that phenomenalism has always had is that you cannot reconstruct what we would call a substance, an enduring thing or entity, by means of its appearances. And that's why in the 30s, basically, in the 30s, phenomenalism was given up in this country in philosophy. It was because they simply found that you couldn't reconstruct the ordinary objects that we have knowledge of in that way. Now, as far as I can give to your question, is simply you would find out what that nature is by examining any particular kind of thing. And in some cases, you need science to help you with it. So, for example, we had no knowledge of atomic power for a long while, and yet that was there all the time in the elements, uranium and plutonium and so forth. So it's a long story in answer to your question as best I can, but the way you do that is by examining it, finding out how it behaves, testing your beliefs about it. And now, see, the same thing is true of personal relations. We have a real problem in this country today with personal relations. Many people don't know how to get married. And it's a tragic thing. Their heads are full of stuff which have never been put into the knowledge of concrete human relationships. And you can only know that by living in them. Now, with reference to physical things, we know that there's a range of things called colors and shapes and motions and so on. We know that beneath that there's an atomic structure, and below particles there's subparticle physics, and that's the way we proceed there. We are less at home with the idea that personal beings can only be known by relating to them in certain ways. And there we find thoughts, feelings, will, the body is very important to the person, of course, social relationships. And if you would be willing to try it out, there is such a thing as the soul. And now those are the parts that we find. Everything in reality consists of parts that have properties that enable those parts to fit into larger holes that have properties, and so on, right? And that's just the general nature of reality. So depending on what kind of thing it is. Now, your question, see, brings us to the point that the philosophy of mind I was talking about, that comes fundamentally out of Descartes and the theory of ideas and up in the 20th century shifts over into language, that view is one which simply says that we are only acquainted with stuff that is somehow in our minds. And then so you got to be in my mind, or you aren't, right? And the chair is in my mind. Well, how is it in my mind? Well, we can talk about sensations and images and so on. That's just a fundamentally false description of the mind. And now in philosophy, of course, we have to fight that out. The ordinary common sense way extended in science of approaching things is the way we know how things are. See, the point is, we really do know how they are. Not just we know our ideas about how they are. If you can't make that step, then none of the rest of it follows. And that was where Nietzsche found himself, and that's where roughly Ernst Mach and Mill and the rest of them in the late 19th century, and then it's updated in the 20th century. They couldn't get past that initial move, which says, no, I really can be aware of something that isn't my mind. That's a deep question. I feel bad about that answer. Yeah.
So do you think acceptance of dualism is necessary to understanding the objective nature of reality?
If you mean by dualism that what you know in ordinary conscious is not your mind, yes. And that is sometimes called dualism, though dualism, epistemological dualism, is usually understood to refer to the view that our ideas are radically separate from the world and we can never get to the world. That's a view that I think that we just have to think seriously about and decide whether or not we're going to be prepared to describe what we're aware of, like what I'm aware of right now, as my ideas. Right? Now, you don't think you're my idea. I don't think you are either. Right? See, and so the natural approach to that is that dualism in that sense is true. So now if you don't believe that, then you have to tell stories about how I come to think that you are my idea. And that's what you find basically in Hume and after. I mean, Hume says that we can't possibly know anything independently of our mind, and then tell psychological stories about why we think we do, because he doesn't deny we all think we do. And if you don't believe you do, then you do have a story to tell. See, so much of modern philosophy is taken up with storytelling. You tell stories. First of all, you say something couldn't possibly be true, and then you tell a story about how people come to think it's true. And you can tell a Kantian story, a Humean story, a Hegelian story, a Marxist story, Nietzschean story, Wittgensteinian story. You come all the way up. But you have to be careful about stories, because stories are not very illuminating accounts of what actually happened. I don't know if any of you have ever read Charles Lamb's dissertation on a roast pig. Have you? I mean, he tells a story about how we came to roast pigs, which you might think would be puzzling. Right? I mean, pigs, if you'd never thought about it, you might not think to roast a pig. But he tells back in the days when pigs lived in the house, one day a child caught the house on fire. And after it burnt down, well, he was trying to get the pigs out. And they burnt his fingers, and he stuck them in his mouth. And he tasted something wonderful. And so after that, more and more houses burned down. Until they finally figured out you could build a fire just to cook a pig, right? Well, you know, you say, wow, that explains it. Well, not necessarily. And, you know, whether it's me or anyone else, if you find someone telling stories to explain how things happened, you want to always think, well, there might have been another way. And likewise, when we come back to our philosophers and we have Hume telling us that, well, it's just a custom that leads us to think that when I look back at this man for the 15th time, I saw the same person, same thing I did the other times. See, Hume's view is I didn't, because my sense impression was not the same, and what I see is my sense impression. And so why do I think you're the same? Well, he says, it's just habit. It's a custom that leads me to believe that you're the same. You know, you can probably smell roast pig at that point. There's something wrong with that. Yes. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Are you willing to say what you think Jesus meant when he said,
"No, be true"? Sure. Now, he didn't say that. The question is, would I be willing to say what Jesus meant when he said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free"? Now, see, that's what it says on the elevator in the humanities building at USC. You will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And now, sometimes it doesn't even say the first part. It says the truth will make you free. That's what it says on my building, the philosophy building at USC. I bet it says it somewhere around here. Jesus said, if you dwell in what I say. Now, he was teaching about the kingdom of God. And he was presenting himself as someone to be trusted. And if you trust him, then you believe what he says, and you put it into practice. So all of his teachings in the Sermon on the Mount and elsewhere, those are teachings about the kingdom of God, the reality of the kingdom of God. And now you want to read him just like you'd read Plato. Or other. I mean, they're all talk. See, every great thinker has to tell you what reality is. No exception. You don't pass unless you say that. And so Jesus does that. He says, reality is God and his kingdom. And here's how you live in it. He gives you his teachings. And among other things, talks about how the Spirit will be with you, and how he will be with you, and how God will be with you as you do these things. If you read John chapter 14, you'll see that's the way it's laid out. It says, if you keep my commandments, then my Father and I will come and move in with you. Right? And so that's what he's saying. Now then, if you do that, then you will harmonize with reality in such a way that your life will be fulfilled, because it integrates a world far beyond you into your own life. Right? Now he doesn't say that you do this by your own spiritual muscles. I mean, there's the teaching about his presence with you. Later, that is commonly called grace. Grace. See, grace is God acting in your life to do something you can't do on your own. And when you do that, then you will increasingly be free of something standing over against you and saying, no. You will increasingly be free of that, partly because of the redirection of your own will.
We have time for one more question.
Right here? Well, there would be a lot of similarity. The question is, how would Nietzsche come over against other world religions? And there would be a lot of similarities. Because, see, all of the world religions incorporate a lot of good sense. And, you find people often resisting something just because some other group accepts it. I'm not going to give up breakfast just because Confucians eat it. You know? It's a good idea. So now that's not the end of the story. See, often I'm in my own life. I'm often in campus settings where we're doing interfaith stuff and discussing all of this. And occasionally, there is an appropriate occasion for me to say, no one understands God who does not understand that God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever put their confidence, their trust in Him, should not perish but have everlasting life. Which of the other religions teach that? Anyone? Now, you see, the religions really are different, okay? And we have to be honest about it. And the only people who really don't believe that the religions are different are people who don't believe anything. See, I watch kids come from Saudi Arabia to USC, and they have someone standing there telling them, now all the religions are the same. They don't believe that. There's no reason why they should. There's every reason why they shouldn't. They aren't the same. We don't compliment people by washing out the distinctives of their faith and saying, oh, it's all the same. It isn't all the same. We should respect people enough to say that's the way it is. So now then, the test is put it into practice. And, you know, many folks come to this country and they say this is a Christian culture and they don't see a lot to admire. Now, I'm not saying that it isn't there. Sometimes it's hard to see. Generally speaking, you have to have some sympathy for people who might wonder if a consumerist society, such as we are, thinking about ourselves the way we do, living as we do, is really superior. Well, you know, I would want to say that isn't the issue, but that's the way the issue presents itself. So we want to, if we can learn something from anyone, we should learn it. And the truth does not respect persons. So we want to be honest with ourselves about what other people can teach us. Like Frank Laubach, a very great Christian and statesman of the middle of the century, was a Presbyterian missionary in the Philippines on an island where there was a tribe called Moros. And the Moros were very fierce people, but they were also very faithful to Islam. And Islam, you know, means submission to God, submission. And Laubach got to thinking, what would it be like for a Christian to be submitted to God? What an idea. You know? And I recommend to you to read his account of what happened to him when he began to put this into practice. So, Frank Laubach, L-A-U-B-A-C-H, Frank Laubach. And he's the one that started the World Literacy Crusade. God gave him a way of teaching people to read from their spoken language. and it went worldwide. He was actually influential in the Truman administration on foreign policy in Europe just because of who he was. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.